I'm Brad Linder, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller's off this evening. Tomorrow marks Election Day for the Democratic and Republican primaries in Pennsylvania and Delaware, which means presidential hopefuls from both parties are making last-minute campaign stops before the polls open. Republican frontrunner Donald Trump is at Westchester University, and WHYY's Dave Davies joins us live from the scene.
Yeah, it's over, Brad. More than 2,000 people packed into a gym here at Westchester University, and this crowd was pumped. You know, I have covered presidential campaign events since the 80s. The only time I remember seeing this much energy was in 2008 when Barack Obama rocked an audience in Germantown. Trump spoke for an hour, no notes, just stream of consciousness. Here's an example. He begins by responding to somebody in the crowd who shouted, "Build the wall." And then he lapses into a discussion of Ted Cruz and John Kasich making an alliance against him.
"Now, if I see, well, we'll build a wall. Don't worry about it. Don't worry. We'll build a wall. That wall. No, I see Lion Ted Cruz the other day said, we must build a wall. You know, oh, this guy. Ay, ay, ay. I watched him this morning. So they bind together. And I wrote out a little thing. I thought it was great. I was really happy. I get a call at 11:30 last night. Cruz and Kasich. Now, let's call Kasich. Kasich is doing worse than many of the people that left months ago. This is just a guy who's a stubborn guy who eats like a slob and shouldn't have press conferences while he's stuffing stuff down his throat. Honest, I've never seen anything like it."
And, Brad, as you can hear from that mocking insult aimed at Kasich, Trump is discarding advice that he act more presidential. He says he wants to stay with his game. There were a couple hundred angry protesters outside, and a few inside interrupted Trump's speech. They were efficiently and peacefully ejected. Trump says he'll win tomorrow and move on to Indiana. Reporting live from Westchester, Dave Davies, WHYY News.
At a campaign stop in Philadelphia today, Republican presidential candidate John Kasich defended his decision to team up with Ted Cruz in an attempt to beat back frontrunner Donald Trump. WHYY's Katie Culinary was there.
Here's the plan. Cruz will back out of contests in New Mexico and Oregon, while Kasich has agreed to stop campaigning in Indiana. The goal? To deny Trump the nomination by keeping him from getting the delegates he needs to avoid a contested convention. Over a plate of fried eggs at the Penrose Diner in South Philly, Kasich explained it this way.
I don't have, you know, like Daddy Warbucks behind me giving me all this money. I have to be careful about my resources.
But the deal concerns Kasich supporter Daniel Levy, who says he'd prefer the candidate go it alone.
"I was a boxer. In the boxing ring, all you see is your opponent and your medical team and your coach. If you can't win by yourself, then it's no point."
Denise Fury says she doesn't have a problem with it.
"I don't think it's undemocratic. I think it's their choice."
But Trump voter Chris Botta says the Kasich-Cruz alliance sums up his problem with the Republican Party right now.
"That's what really gets me, is they're always trying to get ahead of Trump. If everybody hates him, he's got to be the right guy."
"Why is that?"
"Because he says what I feel. He says what I've always felt, which is one man, one vote, government for the people, by the people."
Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has been crisscrossing states where voters will cast ballots in primaries tomorrow. After a morning rally in Connecticut, Sanders addressed a big crowd at the University of Pittsburgh this afternoon. The Democrat focused on how expensive it is to get a college degree today.
"Should we be punishing young people for the crime of getting an education? I don't think so. So what are you going to do about it? All right. What we've got to do is fight back, and here is the good news. The good news is the vast majority of the American people agree with us."
Sanders then moved on to his main proposal on higher education.
"What we have got to talk about is making public colleges and universities tuition free. Does anybody here think that that's a radical idea? It is not a radical idea. It is a common sense idea."
Sanders is due back in Philadelphia tonight for an appearance on MSNBC and a rally. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's made multiple appearances in Pennsylvania and Delaware in the lead up to tomorrow's primary election, and members of her family have been on the campaign trail as well. Chelsea Clinton is in Philadelphia this evening for a fundraiser, and she joins us now on Newsworks Tonight. Chelsea, there are five states holding elections tomorrow, but what's your mother's message to voters specifically in the Pennsylvania and Delaware regions?
Well, thank you so much, Brad, for taking the time to talk to me today. I really appreciate it. I think my mom has a better record of actually being able to get things done, of really solving problems that Americans face in our lives, to protect the progress President Obama has made. And she's the only candidate who's committed to not raise middle-class, working-class taxes, to be able to do what she wants to do in healthcare, education, the environment, the economy, or really any other area. So I hope all that will matter to voters in Pennsylvania and Delaware tomorrow at the polls.
Now, you mentioned that she's got a record of doing certain things. Can you think of a specific example of something that you think really should speak to people about why she might be a better choice than her opponent?
Sure. One that I think about a lot now as a mom. I remember when my mom fought for universal health care coverage in 93 and 94, and she fought really hard. And when she wasn't successful, I would have understood as her daughter if she said, oh, I'm just tired, maybe there's a better day to wage this battle again in the future. But that's not what she said or not what she did, because of all the things people have accused my mom of, even recently, I don't think anyone's ever accused her of being a quitter. So instead of giving up, she spent 3 years building a bipartisan coalition to create the Children's Health Insurance Program. That now insures more than 100,000 kids here in Pennsylvania, more than 8 million children across the country.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Bud. Take care.
Chelsea Clinton is in Philadelphia this evening on behalf of her mother, Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Is it possible to have a civil discourse on the divisive issue of gun control legislation? Attendees at Beth Shalom Congregation in Elkins Park will find out Wednesday evening when they hear from advocates on opposing sides of the issue. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller sat down with Chelsea Parsons, Vice President of Guns and Crime Policy from the Center for American Progress, and Adam Bates, Policy Analyst for the Cato Institute Project on Criminal Justice. He got this preview of Wednesday's event.
Well, what did it take to get the two of you in a room?
It actually doesn't take much. And I think the reason for that is when you get off of Capitol Hill and you get outside of the context of the very partisan, politically charged conversations about gun policy in America, and you actually have regular people having conversations about this issue, it's not as divisive and fraught a conversation as one might think.
Though, Adam, it's certainly a complex conversation. How does one frame it? Is it a criminal justice issue, mental health, public health, commerce, some of each?
Yes, it is all of those issues. And it is a complex issue. And I think one of the benefits of having a civil discourse and sitting down and talking to people and trying to persuade them is you get a chance to delve into that complexity instead of reducing the entire issue down to a bumper sticker slogan or political talking point.
Chelsea, do you agree the goal is persuasion? Is it you win, he loses, vice versa? Or is there some sort of a middle ground possible?
The ultimate goal is to come to a place in our current contemporary culture in this country where we can have an open and respectful conversation about gun violence and gun culture and the Second Amendment and the role of firearms in our society, and figure out where we have places of agreement and how we can then turn that into action to address some of these challenges that we have in our country.
That sounds good. And with that, Adam, what would you agree are some of the nuggets and kernels from which you can start?
I think there's a general consensus that dangerous people should not have firearms, that people who manifest some kind of violent tendencies basically forfeit their rights to bear arms. I think there's an agreement that there's a problem here, and we agree about some of the outcomes that we want. We may just disagree about what policies achieve those outcomes.
Though with such a hot button topic, some feel that any give back is a precursor to a slippery slope.
That's part of the kind of highly charged partisan rhetoric I think you hear a lot, is we have to take a firm position because to give an inch is to give a mile. And I think what we hope to accomplish by having conversations like this is to build more trust between the different communities who are working on this issue so that we can actually try to dig into where is there some consensus and how do we make progress on this issue.
We have these kind of discussions and debates all the time in D.C. I mean, that's kind of what organizations like Cato and CAP do. But I do think it's important to get outside the Beltway and have these conversations in communities where they may not have been exposed to a serious but civil discussion about issues like this.
And, you know, we hear all the time that when one does get away from the Beltway, normal Americans, for a lack of a better term, do think in more moderate terms around any number of hot button issues, though ultimately, though, doesn't it have to return to the Beltway where this issue will ultimately be decided?
This is what's evident when you look at some of the polling on some issues. There's been lots of polling on background checks, and the polling shows high levels of support among vast majorities of Americans supporting that policy, yet when it comes to passing that kind of legislation in Congress, it hasn't moved forward at all. So that's part of the benefit of starting at the grassroots to then filter up to the policymakers, kind of, this issue is important, and here's how we think it should be handled.
And so, Adam, I'm curious, how does the Cato Institute square its positions on this issue with public polling results that might be at variance?
We argue from a libertarian perspective, from an individual rights and constitutional perspective when it comes to things like gun rights and on a variety of other issues. So when it comes to what our principles are, those aren't really affected by what the polling data says. For us, it's about the principle of the thing. One thing I would like to highlight is I think there's a big divide in America on the gun rights issue based on where people live and what their experiences were growing up. It's especially useful for people who, for instance, may have lived their entire lives in Philadelphia to hear what gun rights means to somebody like me from Oklahoma and vice versa. I think there's a lot of talking past each other on this issue because people come from different backgrounds, and hopefully this is a chance to kind of reconcile that.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you for engaging in civil, informative discourse as a precursor to the event coming up. Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Chelsea Parsons is Vice President for Guns and Crime Policy from the Center for American Progress. Adam Bates is Policy Analyst for the Cato Institute Project on Criminal Justice. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org.
Still ahead, the private sector moves in on space exploration as governments fund their programs less.
NASA had a blank check, so to speak, in the 1960s to chase the moon landings. And the checkbook was closed a bit in the era of the space shuttle program.
That's coming up as NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Name-calling, personal attacks, allegations of illegal campaign activity. Two candidates running to be the Democratic nominee for Bucks County's congressional district have pulled out the whole negative campaigning playbook to try to win votes. But as WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports, you can't predict what makes voters punch the ballot.
Democratic primary opponents Steve Sanicero and Shaughnessy Naughton are on a breakfast offensive, wooing potential supporters with free meals around the 8th District. On a recent Saturday morning, Naughton, a scientist by training, dished out her talking points over dwindling coffee and pastries at Pat's Bistro in Levittown.
You know, I think we benefit from having diversity of experience and background. And the fact that I'm a small business owner, a lot of politicians talk about small business and really don't understand or know what the challenges facing us are.
2 days later, Sanicero was at the Golden Dawn Diner on New Falls Road, treating a couple dozen district residents who responded to robocalls.
All right, well, good morning, everyone.
He likes to start his pitch with the day he says put him on the path to public service, September 11th, 2001.
And it was one of those events that really made me stop and think about what I was doing, and I decided I wanted to have something to do that would really give back more to the community.
He quit his job at a law firm to become a high school teacher and eventually ran for public office.
Now, I was a township supervisor in Lower Makefield before I got elected to the State House. In both capacities, I've always fought for the people I represented.
While the candidates mostly focus on issues and folksy origin stories in these small, soft-sell events, what they run over TV airwaves is another matter.
Why should we trust a Harrisburg politician like Steve Sanicero?
Naughton's campaign paints Sanicero as a do-nothing career politician who's exaggerated his accomplishments in Harrisburg, misleading voters.
His campaign brags about his accomplishments, but in fact, he has failed in 54 attempts to get any legislation on the books.
Sanicero did co-sponsor dozens of bills that passed, but just as many that he spearheaded languished in committees in a Republican-majority House. While he says he's never overstated his accomplishments, he makes a point to frame them carefully in person.
I've had two pieces of legislation that one became law as an amendment to another bill. The other was an ethics bill that was designed to create bright line rules in the wake of the Bonusgate scandal. That became part of our ethics rules in the House.
For its part, Sanicero's camp says Naughton is illegally coordinating with a political action committee that she started.
Shaughnessy Naughton's dishonest attack on Steve Sanicero called incendiary. No wonder she's been questioned for violating the law. The truth.
Steve Sanicero well, is endorsed by. Is Governor it true? We do know that her campaign manager and fiancé, Josh Morrow, has worked for the PAC that she started at the same time as running her campaign.
Well, that's pretty okay. That's pretty bold.
That's Larry Noble, counsel with a D.C. think tank, Campaign Legal Center. But he says just working for both doesn't necessarily break the law, barring coordination between candidates and independent PACs.
You know, if you could show that he discussed with them what her campaign was going to do, and then he stops working for them and they use that information, then you could very well have coordination. How would you prove it? That's always the difficulty in coordination cases.
With all the squabbling over personal conduct, it's easy to overlook the candidates' similarities. Naughton and Sanicero are both progressive candidates who've received big checks from national interest groups. They both support expanding early childhood education, lowering the cost of college, and tougher gun control. And while they may try to sway voters with negative campaigning, people are free to choose a candidate based on nearly anything. 83-year-old Ruth Custer, one of the people at Naughton's Breakfast, says she supports her for one reason.
I was decided when I came in here. Women think past their ass, as I say. Because the men have tunnel vision.
Veteran Boy Scout leader Lou Moore did his thinking with his stomach and went to both candidates' breakfasts.
I'm an old guy, and I live by myself, so anytime I get a free meal, I'm there. So, but this is better than Shawnee's breakfast.
That's one vote for hash browns. As for the congressional race, he says he's undecided. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
In a few years, there will be an out-of-this-world experience that has nothing to do with NASA, the European Space Agency, or actually any government agency. Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller spoke with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, about the private expedition.
Derek, who's got the deep pockets and where are we going?
We have two players that have joined forces to work together. One is United Space Alliance, which is a group of former aerospace engineering companies that have decades and decades of experience at building launch vehicles and managing space projects, and a relatively newcomer to the game, Bigelow Aerospace, which we have spoken of recently as a group that is creating inflatable habitation modules, one of which has just recently been brought to International Space Station for experimentation over the next 2 years. And these two together can essentially build their own space facilities. So we have a way to get the components up. Now, because they're inflatable, that means they're much easier to launch because you can compact them down to a much smaller size and then inflate it in place. They are all interchangeable or connectable. That will allow you to make whatever kind of construction you wish.
When and how are they looking to turn a profit on this?
Well, that, of course, is the big question. What they're doing is they are creating the platform where some entity can use the space environment in a way to create new products, new manufacturing processes. You know, NASA had a blank check, so to speak, in the 1960s to chase the moon landings. And the checkbook was closed a bit in the era of the space shuttle program. Now, we're talking about manned exploration in this case because we find that the other kind of work that NASA's been doing using the space platform has been fantastic. A lot of great advances have taken place. But that checkbook for manned space exploration, NASA has to struggle to get Congress to open it wide enough to get the pen in to even put a few numbers on the check, let alone provide what's necessary to move things forward at a rapid pace. So this opportunity that involves independent industry really doesn't have those restrictions and can run ahead at a much faster pace.
In that context, it's hard to imagine that 44 years ago this month, Apollo 16 went to the moon.
Yeah, it may be difficult to imagine that. And in fact, there how many generations of kids have grown up with the manned landings on the moon as a dim history fact, just a point in history, whereas for the rest of us, that was a magical time in which we believed that anything could be accomplished, absolutely anything. And so, right, this coming Wednesday, April 27th, will be the 44th anniversary of Apollo 16 returning to Earth. The astronauts arrived and spent 3 days on the moon, and it was Charlie Duke and John Young who were down on the surface. They did three EVAs while they were out on the surface, a 7-hour, and then a 5-hour EVA, and they had a moon buggy that they drove around for a total of almost 17 miles. And they brought back 209 pounds of rocks, and they were there to actually confirm the formation of the lunar highlands. The lunar highlands are the very, very bright white regions that we see on the surface of the moon, and they're now recognized as being the oldest portions of the moon.
But unlike our evolving understanding of Mars, the term seas in no way refers to water once upon a time on the moon.
No, not at all. We know that at no time in the moon's history was there ever water on the surface of the moon. But the term seas comes from the ancient observations, what they looked like to very, very early observers, what they thought the surface of the moon might be like.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today by Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Brad Linder for Newsworks Tonight.